I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. Dogs have been a part of our lives for thousands and thousands of years. Early on, dogs were our ancestors' hunting companions and acted as guards, using their keen sense of smell to sniff out danger. Over time, through adaptation and training, this relationship has evolved into the one we have today. And we have some things in common. Dogs and people both have a need for social connection, both have the ability to communicate, and both have skills to forge strong bonds. And there's a reason that millions of us share our households with dogs. We love and care for them, and they give us loyalty, devotion, and what feels like unconditional love. Well, on today's show, we examine the connection between humans and dogs, why it runs so deep, and what each of us gets from that relationship. And we have two guests. Alexandra Horowitz is a professor of canine cognition at Barnard College, author of many books on dogs, including Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know, and Our Dogs Ourselves. Alexandra, nice to have you with us on the show, and nice to talk to you again about dogs.
Great to talk to you, Marty.
Also with us is Clive Wynn, a psychology professor who directs the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University. And he wrote a book called Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. And Clive Wynn, nice to have you with us today on The Connection as well.
Great to be with you, Marty.
And I know you two know each other. I guess it's a very connected world of canine researchers. Clive, if I could begin with you. Actually, Alexandra, let me begin with you with a big global question about humans and dogs. What has made this bond so enduring, so singular, do you think, as you look over time?
I do think that the bond has been enduring, but I think the nature of the bond has probably changed quite a bit from the time that the first dogs were domesticated or proto dogs, you know, then wolves started to accompany humans in life. So while they were, for instance, probably mostly used in a functional way in our early connections, now most often they're companions when they're having a kind of one-on-one relationship with persons. Not to say they weren't companions early on, but I think their function has become sort of to be members of our family, to join us. And so one thing the dogs have there is a behavioral flexibility, which allows them to be all those types of things to us, regardless of what we're asking of them. And I think that's part of what makes them special.
Well, and Clive, picking up on that, let me quote you. You have said the emotional connection between humans and dogs is the essence of the relationship. Expand on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I agree entirely with Alexandra that the amazing thing about dogs is how wonderfully flexible they've been over the millennia. They've been so many different things to our ancestors at different points in time and different things to different people today. But the glue that keeps us and them coming back for each other is, I think, an emotional glue. And I think that dogs have this have evolved this amazing capacity to form strong emotional bonds with members of other species. I mean, social animals form bonds with members of their own species. But what's so striking about dogs, and of course about ourselves, is that we're willing and able and ready to extend these emotional bonds beyond our species boundary and towards other species. And dogs are just so amazingly good at that, that even when they're not being useful, and dogs, as Alexandra said, have been so useful to so many people over the millennia, but even when they're not being useful, we still want to care for them because they're just such good company.
Because they're dogs. Well, Alexandra, let me go back to you. And even as I was writing up today's show, I think it's important to remember that most dogs in the world are not companion animals. They live outside in the world somewhere. They're not home in a nice little bed by our beds.
And I think it is surprising for most people to hear that I think an estimated 3/4 of the global dog population are free-ranging dogs. So those are dogs, though, who live around humans. They might just not have the Western relationship with humans that we're thinking of when we think of living with dogs, which is to say, you know, I have two dogs astride me right now, right, sitting on the couch with me. that's not the relationship of a village dog, potentially in Morocco, where they're in a community of dogs and people, but not really owned by a specific person. Still, they live around humans. So that is the common element of most of the world's dog population.
And I have to say, Clive, when I see that, it makes me sad. And maybe I'm anthropomorphizing dogs, that they need us, and maybe they don't, or maybe we need them more than they need us. But it does make me sad when I see a lost or lonely dog.
Well, so, yeah, I share your feeling, Marty, when I have seen these dogs myself, and they're often, not in the best health and so on. But on the other hand, there are many different, one thing is, as Alexandra and I both said, dogs are amazingly adaptable.
Right.
And the other thing is that much as we love the dogs that we keep as pets inside our homes, they are in some sense captive animals, They're not allowed to follow their own whims. They're not allowed to go where they want, when they want. And so there are forms of freedom that free roaming dogs enjoy that our pet dogs do not. And on balance, I don't know, if I was born a puppy, what kind of a life would I rather have? A lengthy life with veterinary care, which of course I wouldn't understand what was going on, but my life would be twice as long. But on the other hand, I probably would never have sex. I would certainly never have, I say certainly, I mean, most pet dogs are neutered, so they're never going to have sex. They're never going to have offspring. They're never going to choose which way to go. I mean, there is a sense in which our pet dogs are captive animals, So I don't think it's all, I mean, I'm not arguing that, I wouldn't for a moment want to argue that the street dogs of Calcutta have a better life than my own beloved Zephos here. But on the other hand, I think there are arguments both ways, and we should keep that in mind.
Absolutely. And Alexander, you wrote a book about a puppy, the sort of first year of a puppy. Can you speak for puppies and rather they be free range or living with us?
I think Clive brings up a lot of interesting points that I've reflected on over the last few years as well for myself in thinking about if I can give my captive dog, or what we just usually call my dog, choices and opportunity to decide who they want to be friends with, right? Or which way even we're going to go, or how long to spend sniffing, rather than so circumscribing their life as to just be sort of waiting for me all the time. So, I think the litters of puppies that I have observed as they grow up are drawn to people, and people are responsive to them, and they want to be around people. But I do think it's a pause, it's a time, a moment for reflection to think about whether we are giving them as many options as we think we are when we indulge our dogs.
Alexander, do you think dogs have made us better people? I mean, broadly speaking.
I think that it opens up the possibility of empathy toward non-humans, right? Or just others, social others. So interacting with the dog deeply and over a long period of time, one, I think, has to start to imagine that animal's point of view. And I think that kind of empathetic understanding can be something that improves us generally. So we have empathetic understanding to non-dogs and to people whose lives we don't know about. So there's that possibility for sure, but not by necessity, right? I mean, dogs, they can be members of the family, but lots of people also just treat them as sort of accoutrements, as objects, as just another thing that they own. And I'm not sure for it, that relationship is that edifying.
Same question to you, Clive. I mean, do you think dogs have, again, this is speaking about all human beings and all dogs, but have they made us better people?
Well, it's a great question, Marty. Everybody who knows me and my dog says that I am a better human because I have.
There you go.
But I don't know. I don't know that I can generalize that to the other members of the human species. Certainly, what I would say is that dogs have made the modern world possible, and we don't so much think of dogs as our helpers in a practical sense anymore, but they were until very, very recently indispensable. I mean, and I still think that a dog, I actually want to do this as a study, but you can buy smart doorbell camera things that are supposed to be able to recognize your friends and alert you if a stranger approaches. And I suspect that there are still plenty of dogs who do a better job of discriminating stranger from friend at the front door than even the smartest smart technology. So dogs have been and remain immensely useful for people. Whether they make the whole human population better, I'm not sure. Can I circle back to something
You
that
sure
you
can.
mentioned?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Alexandra and I were both talking. Alexandra brought up that 3/4 or maybe even more of the world's dog population don't live as pets inside homes, but are free roaming, usually not that far away from people, and usually with some kind of a relationship with people. And we also spoke about how dogs seek out and desire strong relationships with people, which then makes you wonder about all these dogs living on the streets of
Right.
poorer parts of the world. What do they get relationships with people? And there's a wonderful research group studying the dogs on the streets of Kolkata, India. The leader of the group is Anindita Bhadra, who's a terrific scientist. And she published a study a few years back asking the people in the poorer parts of Kolkata what they think of these dogs in the streets. And I thought this was very interesting because in that kind of an environment, these dogs are objectively, they're mostly a nuisance, right? They're pooping in the streets and you're stepping in it, and they're barking at night and keeping you awake. And sometimes you sort of stumble on them while they're trying to eat some kind of trash and they'll growl at you. So they would seem to be, the street dogs of Calcutta would seem to be primarily a nuisance to the human inhabitants of that city. And yet, in this study where Anandita and her students asked the local people, in a poorer part of town, what do you think of these dogs? The overarching impression that people had of the dogs was, in fact, positive. Most of the people, on average, viewed the dogs at least mildly positively, which I think is a really strike. It's easy for me to love my dog because she's very little bother. But it's really striking to me that even in the poorer parts of a poor city, people have an in general, positive attitude towards those dogs.
And Clive, we're almost up on a break here, but just a quick follow-up. So that is that emotional connection that you were talking about?
Exactly. I think that people and dogs have an emotional draw towards each other, which comes through even in quite unlikely circumstances.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. And yes, we are talking about dogs today on The Connection because we have this extraordinary bond with dogs and they appear to have it with us. And we're talking with two of the leading researchers when it comes to canine researcher, and that's Clive Nguyen. He's a psychology professor. He directs the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called Dog is Love. Why and How Your Dog Loves You. Alexandra Horowitz, professor of canine cognition at Barnard College. She's written a bunch of books, including Inside of a Dog and Our Dogs, Ourselves. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Today on the show, we are talking about the dog-human connection. And again, our guests are Alexandra Horowitz and Clive Nguyen. Alexandra, let me just pick up on something that we think about with dogs being our so-called best friend. When I think of a friend, I think of someone I can trust. I think of the kind of empathy that we have for each other, the kind of caring that we have for each other. Can we, should we think of dogs as our friends, and should they think of us as our friends?
That's a great question. I do think that in some respects, and maybe this is also true with human friends, the dog-human relationship is a little bit unusual in that it's not entirely reciprocal. In other words, I think that part of our relationship with dogs is that it's easy for us to put on them certain characteristics that we want in a friend. So for instance, you know, a lot of people, especially women, like to talk to dogs. And yes. I don't mean just
yes,
say the
do.
Occasional thing, right? But like have,
yes, all
have
the
full
time.
Conversations, reveal things, share intimate details. And the dog is, of course, seems to be a perfect listener, right? Never interrupts, doesn't come through with their own experience, right? But just is sort of the vessel for our outpouring of emotion or just our commenting on our feelings in the world. So is that a reciprocal friendship? Not exactly, but they're sort of patient enough and persistent enough and want to affiliate and be with us enough so that they seem to be listening. So I think there is some way in which it's not exactly like a true human friendship. And you might say, listen, you know, a friend is just sort of sitting it out too. They're not really empathetically understanding all the time. But with dogs, it's obviously more profound.
Well, Clive, you wrote a book called Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. And I remember interviewing you on that book a couple of years ago. Love is a strong word. It's a word that we can associate in so many different kinds of ways. What is it that dogs love about us? If I can put
yeah,
it that
well, that's
way.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, love is a four-letter word, and it covers a multitude of possibilities. The kind of love I'm talking about here is love between close friends and parent offspring, parent child love. So the kind of love that we're talking about here is a strong sense of shared bond and reassurance that comes, that one has from having a loved one close by. Plus, as I said before, you know, historically, not so much today, but historically, an enormous amount of shared common effort when people and dogs go hunting together. They're both involved in a very immensely important to them high stakes activity, which is enormously rewarding when it pays off. So just as people that go hunting together have a form of love to their hunting buddies, so that extends to the dogs who are also hunting buddies. And the dogs that guard our homes completely, I want to say involuntarily, right? I mean, you don't have to explain to your dog the importance of barking at strangers who approach your front door. That is such an important shared endeavor that it would be hard not to love. But then our dogs are looking to us. You know, I mean, I don't know whether you want to go in this direction, but there's a lot of debate about, well, just how smart are dogs?
Right.
And I'm on the more skeptical side of that debate. I think that people readily overestimate the intelligence of the average dog. But I think dogs are smart enough to know that we are smarter than them. And so they're looking up to us. And you see this quite literally, you know, when something puzzling happens and you see your dog turn towards you for guidance on how to deal with this. Our dogs are looking to us for leadership, you know, for guidance and leadership about how to deal with things. So we have this interwoven form of life. I wouldn't quite go this far, but there was an author who argued that dogs and people were each on their own incomplete, and that we only really functioned when we were in partnership. Now that I think is taking it too far. But still, I think that we do depend on each other so greatly, and the emotional component is the glue that holds that together.
Well, Alexander, just picking up on that, I mean, I think there is something about dogs and their ability to form relationships with species not their own. But if a dog, let's say, grew up on a farm with ducks or goats, I mean, would they have that social connection to that animal because that's the animal that's been in their life in such an intimate and important way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's certainly possible that they would have a friendship relationship with members of lots of types of species. Yes, especially if they were raised together, if they in those formative first several weeks of their life, they live with ducks, they're probably going to find ducks to be congenial, friendly, maybe even be able to sort of read duck behavior a little bit, not to think that they're a duck, but just to see that as their kind of partner in life, the way they see us if they're exposed to people early in life as their partner in life. And I do want to demur from Clive and I always have friendly disagreements about
just
a little bit about how we would describe dogs. And I don't think that it is fair to call them not smart, because when they look at people and see and ask, you know, sort of ponderously gaze at us when they can't solve a puzzle, I think that that's a very intelligent solution to look at us, because we are the ones who solve all the puzzles. When you look at the refrigerator door and it can't be opened without hands, guess what? Just by looking at me, they can get me to open the refrigerator door. So I think that's actually kind of a brilliant solution. It kind of harkens back to what we think dogs, you know, what we think intelligence is. And I'm very much of that's something that's changed in psychologists and cognitive science vocabulary over the last 100 years. But I'm very much of the mindset that, you know, being well adapted in your niche, and dogs' niches with people, is a kind of smart.
Like a people's smartness.
Yes.
Clive, let me go back to you, because you have, and others, including you, Alexander, but others have said that dogs have this unique ability to follow a pointed finger. I mean, why is that? If we're talking about intelligence, why is that important? Why is that significant?
Well, it's, I don't think it is significant.
Okay. Well, there you go.
But I think the reason it's taken to be significant is because, for an animal to pay attention to and follow the direction of a pointing human finger suggests something about that animal's relationship to people. And early studies back at the very end of the last century and the first decade of this century, early studies seem to suggest that this was something that of all the animal species in the world, only dogs would do this. And if it had indeed turned out to be the case that this was unique to dogs, that all dogs and only dogs will follow human pointing gestures, that would have been thought-provoking. But it just is not the case. There's like 30-something species have been demonstrated to be ready and able to follow human pointing gestures if, and this is the crucial point, if they have grown up around people so that people's movement of their limbs becomes important in their lives. It turns out that there are a vast number of species that if they have that early life experience, which of course is a common early life experience for dogs, but a rare early life experience for most other species, if they have early life experience of people giving them food with their hands, then they learn in their lifetime to just pay attention to where the hands are going and end up in a position to follow pointing gestures.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Clive Nguyen, who joins us along with Alexander Horowitz. And we're talking about dogs today on The Connection, the connection, frankly, between dogs and humans. Alexander, I've lived with cats and dogs, you know, almost my whole life. I don't have cats anymore. But it seems that dogs are so attuned to our emotional state or our tone of voice or what the mood is in the house. I mean, a cat doesn't seem to care, you know, who's angry. They're just being cats. Whereas dogs seem to connect and maybe their emotional state to ours. Am I projecting, or what do you think is going on there?
Well, probably a little projection and probably a little bit of reality reflected there. One of my colleagues, Daniel Mills, who was a veterinarian and also a researcher, suggested that, just offhand, that, and I think it's true, dogs are extremely responsive to like yelling in the environment, for instance, even if it's not at them, right? They just notice it, they are alert to it, they're aroused or excited about it. And if I think about why that might be, it's because they're very good at noticing the differences, right? They live around us all day. They're, especially the dog in my home, right, is knows sort of my routine. And most of the time I might be talking, but I'm not talking to them. And most of the time I'm not yelling. And most of the time I'm not crying happily. So anytime there's something that's quite different in volume and pitch, or clearly directed at them, they're alert to it, right? And so they are responsive to us in those ways. Does that mean that when you're crying, that they are empathetically understanding our experience? Well, I'm a little agnostic about that, and I think it would be a little bit unusual if they were, but they are certainly noticing that something's changed with us, and that's the thing that's changed, an emotional state.
Well, let me throw out a couple emotions to you, Clive. I'm thinking of jealousy, guilt, shame. And again, I'm probably projecting onto my dogs, you know, when they have that look of like, uh-oh, I really, you know, I shouldn't have done that. Do they feel any semblance of those emotions?
Well, I think that they certainly do feel emotion. They feel positive versus negative. They feel happy versus sad, hot versus cold, however you want to conceptualize it. Basic dimensions of emotion appear to be common to certainly all mammal species. And our dogs, I think, certainly feel that. Now, when you talk about emotions like jealousy and guilt, if we wanted to, we could call those cognitive emotions, because there's a layering of thought on top of just the raw feeling, right? So, for example, in order to feel guilty, you need to know what the rules were in the first place. You need to have, you know, a sense of, well, what are the rules of this society? And I mean, Alexandra is in the room with us. She's the one who did the classic study on the guilty look. So many of us have this sense. We come home, the dog is, something is broken, and the dog has a look on his or her face that we interpret as a guilty look. But I want to hand over to Alexandra at this point, because it's her
time. Yeah, go ahead, Alexandra, take it.
This was a fun study, because I have exactly these questions, right? Owner questions, I think, I wish were more often taken on in science. And this one I got to take on, which was just saying, what was the context for this guilty look that we recognize in our dogs, that dogs wear it a little differently, but maybe their head is down and their ears are back and their tail is wagging low between their legs, you know, and what's the context for it, I wondered, and does it show that they are feeling guilt, which is what we assume? And it turns out that, you know, if you just control a couple of variables, that it's really the owner's response to the dog. Even sometimes before people think they're giving a response, before they've said anything, for instance, that the dog is reacting to with this look. It's a learned look, and it's a kind of submissive behavior, an appeasing look, you might say, which they learn to put on to as a protection, so sort of to not be punished. I can see that you're angry. Like, here's my look. That isn't to say, and I feel like I don't know that they don't feel guilt, right? I do agree with Clive. Guilt is something we learn. And in fact, not all humans feel guilt, right? It's something that we learn, that to explain maybe what we're feeling at a time when a rule has been broken. So you not only need to know the rules, but you need to be in a cultural context where you're told that this is how you should feel about it, right? I do think dogs can know some rules, absolutely. But that sense of guilt, it's not expressed in the guilty look. That's just a kind of cute behavior that they put on.
So if they've chewed your slipper and you're coming home, they're not saying to themselves, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. I just chewed mama's slipper.
The moment you arrive and start to discover if there's anything different in the house, that's when they start to feel like I have to respond to you. Right. But if we could videotape them chewing the slippers in our absence, there would be a moments of pure joy. That's the emotion that I think that the dog is experiencing there.
Right.
The guilt is responsive to us because, of course, right, they have to be very responsive to us. And I think, in fact, I once spoke to a humane society where they adopted out dogs having taught them the guilty look, because we feel very happy that the dog might be in on and understanding the, you know, the rules of the house. So it is effective.
It's all about us. I hear you both saying us, meaning us people. But Clive, let me go back to you. I was reading about something called Williams syndrome, and this is a rare syndrome, but you can see it in people, which is a kind of indiscriminate friendliness. And there are some theories that dogs have some perhaps partial gene or some gene that's connected to Williams syndrome. Is that off base or what?
No. You're on the right track. So there's this very rare genetic syndrome that a tiny number of people have called Williams syndrome, and it has a wide range of impacts on people who have it, very wide range. Of which the kind of strangest symptom of it is that people with Williams syndrome have an unreserved friendliness. The medical literature calls them hypergregarious, because they've got to come up with a long-winded term for things. But It's just unlimited friendliness, and it's caused by damage to the DNA. At least two dozen genes are damaged in this syndrome. It's one of the biggest syndromes that people can have. And I read a paper by a wonderful geneticist at Princeton, Bridget von Holt, where she was looking at the DNA of dogs to see parts of the DNA somehow. Geneticists, it's all, I'm waving my hands, but you can't see me because it's all to me, just so all I can do is wave my hands. They can somehow go through the DNA, through the genetic material of animals, and they can see which bits have changed recently. I don't know whether these bits are shinier or what it is, but somehow geneticists can tell where there's been recent change in the DNA, where there's been recent evolution. And if you do this in dogs, then what you're seeing are the parts of the DNA that changed during domestication, because domestication is an evolutionary process. And it's a long paper, and she found lots of things that looked new and shiny. And most of it was extremely boring, at least to me. Except there was one little comment that there was evidence that dog DNA showed recent evolution in a part of the genome, which, if dogs were humans, would be the part that's involved in Williams syndrome. Oh, well,
Fascinating.
that's very interesting. And then, together with one of my past students, Monique Udell, who's now a professor at Oregon State, Monique and Bridget and a team of people did a study where they did behavioral comparisons of dogs and hand-reared wolves. Because you can hand-rear wolves, you can make pets out of wolves. I mean, I don't recommend it for anybody to try at home, but still and all, it can be done. And I'm associated with a group in Indiana called Wolf Park, where they've been hand-rearing wolves for over 40 years. So they're very, very good at it. And they have the most beautifully human-friendly wolves that you could possibly imagine seeing. It's quite a privilege to hang out with their animals. And so Monique did a series of tests comparing just how human-interested the wolves at Wolf Park are, and the same tests on a bunch of dogs. And of course, the dogs are more interested in people than even the most friendly hand-reared wolves. And then she got DNA samples, which is just a mouth swab, completely harmless, and sent them off to Bridget von Holt for analysis. And Bridget was able to identify that the difference in friendliness towards people of dogs and hand-reared wolves is at least in part related to the difference in the DNA of dogs and wolves, and that difference is in the part of the DNA which is responsible for the fact that people with syndrome are so super friendly.
Well, we
So
have,
there's
yeah, that's amazing. That's a wonderful piece of research. I'll tell you what, we have to take another very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about dogs with Clive Wynn and Alexandra Horowitz. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And today we are talking about the dog-human connection with our guest, Clive Wynn. He's a psychology professor, directs the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University, wrote a book a couple of years ago, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. Alexandra Horowitz is a canine cognition professor at Barnard College. She's written a bunch of books about dogs, including Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell and Know, and Our Dogs, Ourselves. I want to just quote a line from a Mary Oliver poem, and she wrote a book called Dog Songs. This was a number of years ago. Wonderful little poems and little essays about dogs. And one of the things she says is, a dog can never tell you what she knows from the smells of the world, but you know, watching her, that you know almost nothing. And Alexandra, you wrote a book about a dog's nose and how the dog sniffs the world and all the information that they have. In fact, describing them as creatures of the nose. Is there a short answer to just what is so unique about their smelling abilities?
They are extremely skilled at olfaction, but almost in a way not unlike lots of other non-primate mammals, right? There are a lot of olfactory creatures. Their skill compared to us has to do with lots of things. Anatomically, their nose has hundreds of millions more olfactory receptor cells than ours does. You know, behaviorally, they stick their noses in things, which actually is a big part of being able to smell the world. We don't stick our noses in as many things. And there's also design of their nose to allow them to kind of continually take in odors, like circular breathing, things that we don't do with our nose. So they're a combination of things that lead to their specialty.
Well, in fact, you have written that dogs smell time. That's a quote there.
Well, that's a hypothesis. But yes, it's a way of my, I mean, my, I'm always interested in the way the dog sees the world. And that includes seeing the world through smell. And if I think about the nature of smells and how odorant molecules move through the world, they change over time. So one of the things that happens is that a strong smell becomes less strong over time. And so at some level, there's information in an odor about how long ago it was left. And we know that tracking dogs, for instance, can tell the difference between the, they can identify footprints of someone who's run away, and they can tell which way that person has gone because the footprint that's closest to where they are now is going to be the strongest smelling one.
Wow.
So the dog just kind of can detect slight increments of intensity of odors. So that's the way I think they're sort of smelling the passage of time rather than, you know, looking at a clock or conceptualizing it. It's just part of the nature of odorant molecules.
Yeah, but it's also so poetic. I love that. Clive, you know, I was thinking putting the show together about that dogs are often our first experience with death. I mean, the dogs live maybe 10 years, 12, 15, maybe more if you're lucky. And yet we, you know, we invite them into our lives over and over again, and over we lose them because they die. But I do think that they do teach us something about life and death and mourning and grief. Have you thought about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it pulls you up short, doesn't it?
It does. Difficult. I mean, I could cry right now because I'm thinking of dogs I have loved and lost.
So I'm the positive. I don't want to say the positive spin. That's crude. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the way I cheer myself up about it is I find it absolutely fascinating and tremendously moving how people have memorialized their dogs. Not just over, you know, not just today, where you can go to a dog's or pet cemetery pretty much anywhere in the world, and not just in the last century where, you know, Queen Victoria built a beautiful monument to the dog of her adolescence and young adulthood, but some of the earliest signs we have that beings are definitively dogs and not wolves, because it's very difficult to tell when you're looking at bones that are many, many thousands of years old. But you can be pretty down sure that you're looking at a dog when you see the care with which people buried their dogs. And last summer I went to southern Sweden and I visited some sites, some of the oldest burial sites that we have for dogs that are, how old are those ones? Those ones were about 12,000 years old. Hmm. And what's so interesting is, you know, the people had no written culture, had very few artifacts of any kind. You know, these are hunter-gatherers living at the very end of the Ice Age in southern Sweden, where it's cold now and was colder then. But they buried their family members, and they put with their family members some red dirt, some ochre, and maybe, you know, like an axe. They might have had a wooden axe or an antler or two, just the things that they had. They have very little material culture. But when somebody they love died, they buried them with these things, these grave goods. And what's so interesting is in this graveyard that archaeologists discovered about 40 years ago, there are dogs, and the dogs are buried with every bit as much care as the human beings are. And some of the dogs, and there was one dog skeleton, you could still make out a little bit of red dirt on it. They buried it with as many tools and antlers and things that they could find as they did for any of their human family members and loved ones. And I think that tells you that these dogs, all that time ago, these dogs were part of the family. They were beloved just like they loved their human family members. So I find that, you know, I mean, in such a sad topic, I find that a very uplifting thought that we love our dogs today. So we connect with our ancestors going back thousands and thousands of years and how they cared about dogs. I find that very moving.
I do too. And I'm sure you do too, Alexandra. Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking about, you know, a lot of people during the pandemic got dogs to, you know, sort of help mitigate some of the loneliness and disconnection that so many people felt. But I'm wondering about, you know, are those dogs, now that people are sort of trickling back to work, are they getting mm-hmm. the social interaction, the connections, the exercise, the contact with the world that they really need?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, well, certainly time will tell whether this was a kind of unusual generation of dogs, right? Just as for the children growing up in the pandemic time, you know, how it in a long-term way affected their development. But I do think that the pandemic was a time when people got to appreciate anew the power of having a companion in your days. And maybe the thing that's happened the most is that we now feel more guilty if we have to leave the dog behind, which maybe is just a responsibility we should have acknowledged that we were taking on to begin with, but that I think more people see now, and maybe our culture has started to shift a little bit toward acknowledging that, you know, dogs actually, if we're going to take in these other sentient animals as part of our life and take responsibility for them, part of the responsibility kind of continues even when you want to go do something else. And it's doable. And I think that's an advancement for our relationship.
I'm going to embarrass myself here, but my husband and I howl with our dog at night. We've decided that this is something he really likes. I'm sure our neighbors think we're absolutely out of our minds. But, you know, again, I don't know whether I'm projecting that he's enjoying this as much as we are.
I mean, absolutely.
Go ahead, Alexander. No, go ahead.
I mean, howling is an affiliative behavior, right? Wolves that howl are sometimes, maybe there's a sort of an emotional contagion. You're making the sound, I want to make the sound too. And also it seems to be used to communicate over some distances, this connection. So if dogs have a little vestigial howl in them, then I'm sure they're enjoying your companionship in that activity.
You agree, Clive?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, now you're making me envious, Marty, because I really enjoy it. My Zephos, my dog, doesn't seem to feel the need. So.
Well, I don't know who started it first. But anyway, let me just ask you, Clive. I'll start with you. But do we sometimes ask too much of dogs? And I'm thinking, I mean, these are sensitive souls. There's a lot of talk about loneliness and depression and anxiety today, therapy dogs, you know, companion dogs that are on buses and trains and planes. Is it asking too much of dogs for them to carry some of our emotional upset?
Oh, I didn't realize that was where you were going to go.
Go ahead, Clive.
I don't know, to carry our emotional upset, I don't, I mean, one thing I do know, every dog is an individual. We've got to be very careful, those of us that stand up and claim to be dog experts, about the advice we give, because your dog is different from my dog. I do think that there is a general thing that our dogs are very, very social, and I think they are very sensitive to being left alone, and too many of us, too much of the time, do shut up our dogs in solitary confinement for most of the waking hours of the day. And that, I think, is cruel. Now, asking them to carry our emotional burdens, that's a mixed bag. That's a mixed bag. I mean, on the one hand, maybe that can become too much. But on the other hand, you couldn't, that my major concern is that people leave their dogs alone too much. And sharing emotional burdens at least means you're not left on your own. So, and I'm not sure how much of our, I mean, after all, the details of our emotional concerns are not comprehensible to our dogs. So there's a great deal of blissful ignorance on the part of our dogs. My dog is never going to understand that. I have two PhD exams I have to be at on Monday and Tuesday next week, which is really and she certainly is not any of the details of this. So she is, as I say, blissfully ignorant. I'd be interested in Alexandra's perspective.
I think
that emotionally loading our dogs is the worst thing we could do to them.
What do you think, Alexandra?
I mean, I do think that they get a lot. I agree with Clive about the isolating dogs being a profound problem for many dogs. However, I do think that they kind of catch our emotions a little bit, right? At least some of those, what we used to call primary emotions, and our stress and anxiety through our behaviors. Sometimes it looks like they could sort of cortisol, our raised cortisol results in dogs raised cortisol. And that's problematic. Now, are they understanding the contents of our emotional dramas? Not, I don't think that they are bearing those. But I think part of your question, Marty, could have been, you know, should they be dragged out to be therapy dogs, to be working for us, right? Brought everywhere because we think that that's better for them, or we want to have them with us. Right. And I think that's an open question that I'd like to answer. I think whether in dog human therapy settings, I wish there were a little bit more focus in research on the dog side of the equation, right? Is the dog calmed by spending the day with people who are using them as a therapeutic device? In some cases, probably yes, and in some cases, definitely not. And so I think it's just something I would want us to be more alert about and have more research on.
Alexandra, let me ask you about the Biden's dog, who apparently has bitten a number of Secret Service members. You wrote a piece in the Times, I think it was, over the summer about, you know, so-called, and I'm using quotes here, you know, bad dogs or misbehaving dogs or even dangerous dogs. How should we think about that?
Well, there are so many aspects to that question. One of the things is sort of what counts as a bite, right? Like dogs very much perceive the world, interact with the world through their mouths, right? That's their hand, essentially. And so when we think of any use of a mouth as a bite, a dangerous bite, I think we're kind of misunderstanding their behavior. And that would be something that culturally we could be better at. And then the other aspect, which is so interesting, is like, is there such a thing as an aggressive dog, or what's more often said, an aggressive breed? And I think that most researchers definitely agree that there's no breed who is more aggressive than any other breed, and dogs are aggressive in reaction to certain situations potentially, but it's not a personality characteristic per se, right? And so I think we have a lot of misunderstandings about behavior and personality that we heap on the dogs, and that's definitely happened to dogs who were in the spotlight, like the Biden's dogs.
Almost out of time here, Clive. I hear from both of you about what we can do to make dogs' lives better, but, you know, and perhaps isolation being the most harmful and hurtful thing for them. But looking ahead, what can we do to make our dogs' lives better?
So my number one thing, we've already said, my number one thing is protecting dogs from loneliness. I feel very strongly about that. I feel you need to treat each dog as an individual. Talking about the Biden's dogs, I mean, clearly the life in the White House is stressful for dogs, as it presumably can be for humans too. And those are just not the right dogs for that kind of lifestyle. They're individuals. They needed a different kind of lifestyle. There have been dogs who've lived happily in the White House, many of them over the years. Get to know your individual dog. A dog is not, you know, people are so fixated on breed. A dog is not a mark of car. It's not like getting another Honda Accord if you get another German Shepherd. Each one is an individual. You need to know the individual and protect them from loneliness. Those are my two right. mantras.
And Alexander, about a minute or so or even less before we have to say goodbye, final thoughts.
I absolutely concur. Know your dog as an individual. Some dogs don't like to be touched in all sorts of places, right? And to treat them the way we'd want ourselves treated by somebody seeing who we are. And let them sniff, I'd say, also. You know, let them have their olfactory experience just as we enjoy our Kodachrome universe. Let them enjoy their smelly one.
I think it was you who said once, Alexandra, that think dog smelling is kind of like us in our cell phones, which is we're always checking all the time, right?
Absolutely, right? And they go outside, it's like staring at the Grand Canyon, and you don't want to have someone snatch your head away.
Exactly. Well, Alexander Horowitz, as always, a great pleasure talking with you about dogs. Thanks so much for joining us today in The Connection.
I love being here. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. And she's a professor of canine cognition at Barnard College. Clive Wynn, thank you very much for joining us on The Connection as well.
Entirely my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. Psychology professor who directs the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.